Well, I heard it fairly often. Gary, mind your manners. And sometimes it got more specific. Get your elbows off the table. Don't chew with your mouth open. Don't talk with your mouth full. Don't grab for the food. Ask it to be passed. Say please, say sorry. Look at me when I'm talking to you. That was some of the music of my youth. And I hope it was some of the music of your youth as well. And it's become the music that my children have heard and my grandchildren on occasion, very rare occasion, hear as well. It's a part of the reality. Usually it went with an explanation. Do you think I want people to think that you were brought up in a barn? Sometimes it appealed to something in me. You want to make a good impression on people. They don't want them to think badly of you. And then more profoundly it was, you know, the Lord Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So that's what manners are. They're a way of showing kindness and consideration to other people. I'm not sure I heard most of that at the time, especially the last one. They were just annoying things that were there. But we've all learned something about the need for manners. And we've always been in a place where we recognize that some people just need to be taught things differently. As a matter of fact, it's become a significant issue in our society, brought on by social media, which is a kind of every man against every other kind of person thing, and in our public life, so that discourse in the United States at this present time is full of hostility and conflict and rudeness and discourtesy, starting from the very leaders of the country and seeping down on all kinds of levels. Manners matter. Somebody has said manners are kind of the stoplights of social relationships with one another. They help stop terrible collisions, and they help us steer together so we can get along with one another. It's not just manners. And we've already always been in, pardon me, we've perhaps often been in places like I have, where we've been in a place and the host or hostess or those in charge were the kind of people who were very full of etiquette, and they would never use the wrong fork at a meal at the wrong time. But you went away feeling icy cold. They did everything by the book, but they did nothing from the heart. Tables are important. Tables matter in our common life. One of the challenges in our society is families don't eat together enough and share in those things that go back and forth at table where they do in no other way. And it's always been that way. In the Middle East, tables were places of enormous significance, especially in the time of the Lord Jesus. It was the place where society kind of worked itself out and worked its way through. Pharisees cared enormously about tables. When you came to a meal, they wanted to make sure that you had done the right preparation, that you'd not only washed your hands, as my mother insisted that I do, but you'd wash them in the right ritual kind of way and that you were in the right state. And they cared that the right food was on the table that was kosher and appropriate. And they cared that the right kind of people were at the table. Because if you ate with the wrong people, you were in some way infected by that attitude and the things that happen. And it's interesting how often in the Gospels, Jesus is depicted at being table, even with Pharisees. And yet the striking thing is that as Jesus was at the table, and the Pharisees went with their rituals that involved saying certain kinds of prayers, he was very concerned to help us understand that tables are not simply a place where you say grace. They're to be tables where you show grace. And the way we eat and with whom we eat is ultimately an issue of understanding the heart and character of God. It isn't just about table manners, but table matters in terms of understanding how God's kingdom works. And we see that vividly in the passage we're going to look at this morning. We're looking at the parables of Jesus, and this morning we're going to be in Luke chapter 14. So if you take your Bible there, we're going to land in a meal scene. And Jesus has his way at these kind of, well, we'll see it. Let's just read. And we're going to go halfway through because we're going to look at the end of the story next week. Luke chapter 14, verse 1. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. And he took the man and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that's fallen into a well on the Sabbath day, would not immediately pull him out?" But they could not reply to these things. Now he told a parable to those who were invited, when he noticed how they chose the place of honor, saying to them, "When you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, don't sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this person,' and then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go sit in the lowest place, that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at table with him. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." He also said to the man who'd invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they can't repay you. Then you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just." It's interesting, as I've said, seven times in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is depicted at being at a table, at sharing a meal with different people. It's in all kinds of different settings and arrangements, but sometimes it's with the Pharisees. But Jesus could be a very awkward guest. The meal often didn't go the way you'd want the meal to go if you were the host, because he had a way of not following the normal protocol, of not keeping the rules of the game. And we see it in this particular story. Now, you'll notice the first six verses give us the kind of setting of the story, especially the first two, this drama that's set up. And I want you to notice three things with me out of verses 1 and 2. The day, the people, and, well, the prop, as we'll see. I'll make that clear in just a moment. It's a Sabbath day. They've probably already been at synagogue that morning, and this is the service after the service in the synagogue. And the very fact that it's a Sabbath day sets it apart. For the Jews in the first century, the Sabbath was one of their identifying marks. It set them apart from all kinds of people. It was the crown jewel of the law. Some of the rabbis even said that the Sabbath outweighs all of the other commandments of Torah, which is absurd when you begin to think about, you mean it's more important than idolatry, more important than only worshiping one God? But clearly, they had the Sabbath in this pinnacle of importance and significance. It's also interesting that Jesus, four times already in this gospel, has come up against the Sabbath issue with the Pharisees. Now, clearly, Jesus believed the Sabbath was part of the law given by God, but it had been added to, and there were traditions and things that were related to it. It's striking that Jesus, already in the book of Luke to this particular point, has done four miracles on the Sabbath day. Three of them he's done in the synagogue itself. And this is going to be the fifth occasion in which he's going to done a miracle. And each time it is going directly against what the Pharisees thought was appropriate on this particular occasion. So here they are, gathered on this particular day, on a Sabbath day. They're in the house of a very significant Pharisee. He's called a ruler of the Pharisees. We're not entirely sure what that means, because the Pharisees didn't have official rulers or official leaders, but clearly he was a Pharisee of the highest order, perhaps like Nicodemus in the Gospel of John, who was both a Pharisee and a member of the Sanhedrin. And he had with him a group of others. Later in the passage, we're told that there are lawyers, that is, experts not in the civil law, but experts in religious law. So the scribes, they're more commonly called, and other Pharisees who were there at this particular meal. These kind of meals after a synagogue service were significant and important on that particular occasion. But as they come in, you could almost cut the atmosphere with a knife because Jesus has been invited. We don't know whether the other disciples are there, but Jesus is there, and you'll notice they're watching him closely. And then there's this other person, this man we're told with dropsy, who's there. Dropsy is not a word that we use very much, but it's somebody who simply has edema. He's got an accumulation of fluid in his body that is making him very obviously ill. I mean, he's evidently sick to people. Dropsy isn't a disease in and of itself, it's a symptom. Perhaps he's a man who has congestive heart failure. And just looking at him, you know that he is ill. And it is impossible to believe in this context that he's just there by accident. He is a prop. He is the bait that the Pharisees are setting in front of him to see what he is going to do on this particular occasion. He's not a person in need. He's a prop, bait for their attack on Jesus. We don't know how long this goes on, how far along Jesus is in front of them, or seeing this man in front of them on a particular occasion, but at some point, enough is enough. And he looks to them and asks this question: is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day or not? Not a question, it's a rhetorical statement. They know immediately there's nothing in the Torah, there's nothing in God's law that says you couldn't heal on the Sabbath. It was a provision of doing ordinary work. But that's not the way the Pharisees and the rabbis had tended to see it. Oh, if someone's life was in danger, perhaps then you could heal them. But it was an open question about whether you should heal. I mean, after all, they could come back the next day. Or on some other occasion, you could do it. Do it at your convenience. Just don't violate the Sabbath. It's more important than caring for a person in need. Earlier in the gospel, in Luke 6, he says almost the same thing as he'll say in the next verse to a group of people. And he said he looked around at them, angry with them for their hardness of heart. He knew it was a setup. And he knew this man was a puppet in front of them rather than a person about whom they cared. And looking around at them, and then he walks over to the man, and we're told simply that he heals him. Do you have authority? Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And Jesus heals him. And then he sends him away. Not to get him out of sight, but to keep him from being the kind of spectator and to make him the object of some kind of game that the Pharisees are playing. And then he comes back in and he looks around and says, with a kind of anger in his heart and certainly on his voice, which of you who had a son or an ox that fell into a pit on the Sabbath day wouldn't take him out? They argued about those kind of things. As a matter of fact, down at Qumran, they said, no, you couldn't take him out on the Sabbath day. You could feed him down there and throw food down to them in the pit, but you weren't to pull him out. And he knew that none of the Pharisees would do it, certainly not for a son, and not even for an ox, because oxen were expensive, and you need to pull them out. And he looks at them with a kind of holy anger. Earlier, he's claimed to be not only the one who has the ability. Isn't it interesting, by the way, as you read this story? They never doubted Jesus had the ability to heal. That's why he was there as a prop. What they were going to debate about was the appropriateness of Jesus' healing on a Sabbath day so they could trap him in this particular way. And they are silent in a kind of shame or maybe a knowledge that we're not going to win this argument. Then Jesus does something that my mother would have said, you don't do that. When you go to somebody's house and you don't like the food, don't say anything about the food. Take a couple of bites and then set it to the side. And don't comment about the other people who are there. Why is so-and-so here? Don't say anything to the... Just, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. she would not have been happy with Jesus. Now, my mother knew Jesus was perfect, so she would say to me, don't use Jesus as an excuse. He was perfect, you aren't. But you'll notice what Jesus does. He begins to talk to the guests and to be strong to them. And then in verse 12, he says, and host, I've got something for you to say as well. That was not following the appropriate script. But Jesus in verse 7, it says, had been watching them. Now we need to understand how this worked. Almost certainly the home was set up with, and this being a Sabbath meal, it appears that they were reclining at table. Sometimes they would sit, sometimes they would sit on the floor, but here they're reclining at table, much as they would on Passover. And the tables were arranged in a horseshoe arrangement. And the host would sit at the head, the middle part of the U shape. You tracking with me? And then the guests of honor would sit closest to him. But there was no seating arrangement. There was no seating plan. You would come in and you would make your own evaluation of where you ought to sit. And the rule was the most important person sits next to the host. So you'd look around the group as you came in and you'd think, who else is here? Well, I'm more important than he is. Maybe not than him. And you'd take a kind of appropriate seat. Now, the other rule was, and we saw it played out even in what went on in Helsinki this week, where one person arrived and the other one managed to show up half an hour later. And even when you get presidents of countries together, the rule is that the most important one comes in last. Well, that's the game they play anyway. And here, the problem is that you could take a seat and then all of a sudden, uh-oh, so-and-so's arrived. So he'd watch this gamesmanship as they were all sitting down. And then you notice it says in verse 7, a parable. Jesus told a parable to those who were seated when he noticed how they chose the seat places of honor, saying to them, now, it's called a parable. When we read it, it doesn't look like a parable. It looks like just sort of shrewd, pragmatic advice about this is how you handle a social situation like this. You maneuver in this particular way. And it looks like Jesus is kind of giving shrewd advice for people at table. But Luke calls it a parable, which means there's more going on here than just reading the story off the top. And so the statement is relatively straightforward. He says, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, don't sit down in a place of honor. Let someone more distinguished than you be invited by this guest. And he comes in later, and all of a sudden you're seated here, and the host comes over to you and says, oh, you're going to have to move. And the only seat that's left is down there. And you're not only going to have to get up here where you thought you were so important, but you're going to have to walk all the way down to the only empty chair way at the bottom, and that's going to be humiliating. So he said, start at the bottom. Go down there, and the host will come, and he'll raise you up. And you'll look important in the presence of others. And it looks like Jesus is really teaching them gamesmanship. As a matter of fact, it's a lot like the book of Proverbs. Proverbs in chapter 25 says in verses 5 and 6, verses 6 and 7, don't put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great, for it's better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. Have you ever been to a party and you've moved in and just sort of stand back because it's not necessarily the people that you know and just sort of watch how certain people grab other people because I want to sit with them because they're important and they arrange their tables and it's fascinating sometimes just to watch the games that we play because I want to sit next to that person because he's socially significant and if I can talk about when I was talking to so-and-so this last week or it's that guy I want to do business with. Need to get to know him better. And There are all kinds of reasons why we want to play these kind of things, and that's what Jesus is talking about, the way social gamesmanship is played. But then in verse 11, he comes to his point. If you're living for your honor, if you're living to promote yourself, if you're living so that people look good or to have self-promotion, you're going to come against a law of God. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. Now, those are what are called divine passives. In other words, whoever exalts himself will be humbled by God. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted by God. He's saying to these Pharisees who viewed themselves as the elite, who were welcome to come to the ruler of the Jews, the ruler of the Pharisees' house, I'm included in this group. I'm in this in-group. I'm of importance and I am significant. But even in there, they're playing their games of who's most important than anyone else. He's saying you're denying the very reality of how you stand in the presence of God. That God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And in your exercise of life, you see yourself as the people. We're the people who keep the law. We're the people who keep these rules and regulations. We're the ones with whom God is pleased. We're the ones whom God blesses. And the parable is simply saying to them in this single way, if you live for self-promotion, and if you live for human promotion, you will miss divine promotion. Because at the very door of salvation is the recognition that I have nothing to claim before a righteous God. Unless I humble myself and come, as Jesus will say, like a little child, unless I acknowledge that I cannot earn my way into God's presence, work my way into God's presence, I am going to be humbled by God himself. I'm not simply going to be at the end of the row in the kingdom. I'm going to be excluded from the kingdom entirely. And then he turns and he has a word for the host. And his word for the host is simply to say, the guest list that you've got here, don't keep doing this. This is not the kind of guest list that you want to make your normal practice. You'll notice what he says in verse 12. When you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they invite you in return and you be repaid. And I'm sure the man thought, no, that's not the way life works. Life works because you do invite your family. You do invite your friends. You do invite people who are important because their importance is important to you and maybe their importance will rub off on you. And you do write with people who have the right kind of social status, the right kind of people that it's good to be seen with, to move with the movers and shakers. Jesus is saying this, not so much that they will never do this. I mean, that's the way much of our entertainment goes back and forth. And in one sense, Jesus is not saying that is wrong. It's not wrong to have friends over. It's not wrong to have family over. And it's not wrong in certain sense, on one level at least, to think, well, there's a kind of repayment. There's a reason for having them over. They've had us over, we need to have them over and repay. How many times do you think that when you know, we haven't had so-and-so over for a while. And they've had us over we need to have them over. That's the way life often works. But Jesus is saying, you need to understand the kingdom works on a different basis. Kingdom doesn't work in terms of reciprocity. You do for me and I'll do for you. The kingdom works on the principle of grace. When you have a party, invite, and you'll notice his guest list. Invite the people who you don't want to be seen with, he's saying to these Pharisees. The poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Some of those people it was easier to look at and say, if they're poor, they deserve it. That was the way the Pharisees tended to think. They talked about ordinary people as Am Haaretz, people of the land, people of the dirt. And the lame and the blind, they were not allowed to go into the temple. And they were probably not able to go there because, they said, they'd sinned in some particular way. And the Lord says the very people that you exclude are the people who you need to invite for the simple reason that they can't repay you. You're not doing it so you will get. You are doing it because you can give. The principle is not reciprocity. The principle is not even generosity. It's grace. Because that's how God's kingdom works. It invites those who do not deserve it to come into the kingdom. It's a challenging thing to think about entertaining, and I love the kindness of people, and I love being invited over to people's house and having people into our house. But I look back as well and think of the times we've had people who were sort of not lame, blind, and specifically that way, but people who couldn't possibly repay us. People who were people visiting students from another country, somebody from another particular situation, somebody who had we had no expectation they would ever give anything. I think of the number of times when we were students and people would have us into our house with no expectation that we would ever have them back into ours. And I think of how my life has been enriched by those times when I've reached out beyond the boundaries, usually when Elizabeth has reached out beyond the boundaries and convinced me to go along with what she had, in her gracious way of looking at things, included and expected and was looking to do in God's name. But there's a promise. And the promise is they can't repay you, but God will repay you. You will be blessed by God. You'll be blessed by taking the risk of opening your home and inviting somebody in. You won't just be blessed now. You'll be blessed in the kingdom. God has an eternal blessing for those who imitate his gracious acceptance of outsiders. It's the heart of God. It's people who do not have a legal right to demand something about you, but who have a need, and you can open your heart and your door to them. Table matters. Table matters because it's not just a place we say grace, it's a place we show grace. Show grace to the undeserving. Show grace by not promoting ourselves, but willing to take the lower place, knowing that God has a scale of blessing and honor that goes beyond anything humanly we can know. It's a passage that challenges me to think about whether, like the Pharisees, I'm scheming to get seen and noticed, or whether I'm willing just to serve and to trust God to deal with my honor and my place. Whether I'm seeing the people who are like me or the people who in some way need something that I can give. As Christians, we need to see people differently because Christ saw people differently. He saw us differently. And so we come to the table. The table that's not based on our merits. The table that's not based on our accomplishments. The table, quite frankly, that doesn't care anything about what your university pedigree is, or your business pedigree, your academic pedigree, or your social pedigree. The table that simply announces, Christ died for my sins, and I'm a sinner. And I believe he died for me, and I receive his gift of salvation. And the table matters because it reminds us that it's all about what God has done for us and all about the salvation and work of Christ. And the amazing thing is, when we say, Lord, I've sinned, and we humble ourselves at his feet and acknowledge, I cannot earn my way to you. Thank you for the gift. I take your gift. He not only gives us that gift, he elevates us so we sit at his table. And Jesus said, take, eat of these things, because I will eat with you in the kingdom when I come. And so this table is a kind of anticipatory symbol of when we sit with the Lord Jesus at the marriage supper of the Lamb, and we celebrate the one who's exalted the sinful into the sons and daughters of the King, the bride of Christ.